I'd like to open the Senate Education and General Government Committee. Welcome, everyone. We have some rather mundane and boring bills on the agenda today. Seriously, we have two small bills to take up first, and we're going to do those. Those shouldn't take long. Before we get there, Senator Cruz, you have something for us?
Yes, and here's for the committee. Last session, we passed House Bill 3141, which was designed to help us deal with a growing problem in the state, and that is the fact that we are finding more and more autistic kids in our system, and we have a massive shortage of language speech pathologists to deal with that. And so in a collaborative effort between Willamette ESD and Chemeketa Community College, we were able, for very very small price tag. We had asked for $250,000. We got $150,000, but with that $150,000, we were able to put an additional 42 speech pathologists in the field. And the beauty of this is it's on scholarship, and all of those pathologists have agreed that when their scholarship is done that they will continue to serve the ESD or the school district they're currently serving for an additional 2 to 3 years. And the reason I bring this up is, Mr. Chair, is because it was a massive success. One of the very positive things we did last session, and also that is supposedly continuing funding into the next biennium for the same $150,000 to further increase the number of pathologists we have in the field, because we're still well short. And the piece of paper I handed out to you will show you where those teachers are located. And quite honestly, Mr. Chair, without this program, some of these school districts, some of these DSDs would have been without any services whatsoever. In fact, I heard an anecdotal thing about one school district that has a pathologist in her 70s, and they're keeping her on staff because they have no other option. So, Mr. Chair, I just bring this to your attention as one of our very successful things we did last session, and I hope we're able to find a way to continue it.
That's outstanding. Thank you, Senator Cruz. Appreciate it. That is good news. Okay. I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 71.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 71 changes the resident school district for charter school students who are eligible for special education and related services from the district that the student's parent or guardian lives in to the district where the charter school is located. It requires the resident school district to identify, locate, and evaluate students in charter schools in the district to determine those who may need special education or related services. We have an amendment before us, a dash one, that changes the applicability date to 2009-2010 school year, and carries an emergency clause, meaning the bill would be effective July 1st, 2009.
Okay, thank you. We heard this bill for the first time our first week in session. The Department of Education is back with this amendment. And Morgan Allen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education, and I'm here today to talk about Senate Bill 71, but kind of feel like the opening act at a Bruce Springsteen concert. Everyone just wants me to get off the stage and get on to the main event, so we'll make this very brief for you. What we're trying to do with Senate Bill 71 is to change the residency for special education students who attend charter schools outside of the district in which they reside. When the charter law was passed in 1999, for some reason, it was decided that students receiving regular, quote-unquote, regular educational services who chose to attend those charter schools that weren't in the districts that they live in were treated as residents of the district that sponsors the charter school. And students who were receiving special education services and had an IEP, an individualized education program, remained residents of the school district in which they live. And this very small group of students attending charter schools outside of their home district is treated differently than the other students attending charter schools in Oregon. And so Senate Bill 71 would change this residency. Again, Mr. Chair, there are about 354 out of the 14,000-plus students who attend charter schools in Oregon who fall into this category. The practical impact of this distinction for these 354 kids is that really no one school district is totally responsible for this, the total education of the student. The resident school district is obviously responsible for a free, appropriate education and responsible for making sure that they're getting the special education services that they need, but the charter school is sort of responsible for delivering those. And then the sponsoring school district that sponsors that charter school is responsible for negotiating with the other district. So this scenario is sort of what happens if you, let's say you live in Corvallis and you want to attend a charter school in Albany and there's extra space. If you're a regular education student, you go to the charter school in Albany and you become a resident of the Albany school district. But if you're on an IEP and receiving special education services, you want to go to that charter school in Albany, you would remain a resident student of Corvallis. So what we end up have happening is this sort of overly complicated layer of bureaucracy and red tape and this web of inter-district contracts and agreements, and the school districts have to notify the resident districts that they have kids coming to their charter school with an IEP. They have to establish these agreements to make sure the state school fund payments are processed, and that can, you know, be a lot of time sort of negotiating that out. You have to have multiple districts and folks sometimes participating in IEP meetings. And then again, sort of this whole, you know, issue of trying to collect and set up a system so that the money follows the student. So what we're trying to do with Senate Bill 71 is just simplify that and say, treat all charter school kids the same, regardless of whether or not they receive special education services. So essentially what we're trying to do is cut out the middleman in charter school law. And so this will sort of mark a clear line of responsibility and give that sponsoring school district and the charter school all of the authority they need to act immediately in the best interest of kids with special education needs. And I think that's really why we brought this forward, is there really should be no lag time or no delay. If you're a kid with special ed and you go to a charter school, the money should, bingo, should follow you immediately. You should get your IEP set up, and the charter school should get the money to deliver the services that you need. Or if they need to contract with the regional program or the ESD to provide those services, there should just be no question and no sort of delay and no bureaucracy in all of this. And passage of the bill will help ensure that all special ed kids sort of have that immediate service that they need. We have heard from one charter school down in the Phoenix Talent area that they have some concerns about this, and we're happy to work with them. If you'd like to give us a little bit of time to see if we could come up with an amendment here on the Senate side, or if you would like to move it over to the House, we would commit to working with the folks at that charter school down in Phoenix Talent to see if we can come up with an amendment to address their issue. It's sort of a unique situation. They have a charter school that has a very high number of special education students, and they have some concerns about how their district might react to all of a sudden being the resident school district for those special ed kids. We believe that it won't impact the funding, but we're willing to sort of sit down and chat with them and see if we can come up with a happy resolution on that. I think the one thing you'll hear from anybody, you know, whether it's you know, COSA or OSBA or the charter school folks, is that this is the direction we need to go. That this sort of provision was put into the original charter law probably out of an unfounded fear that all of a sudden there would be all these special ed kids moving around and all these districts wouldn't have funding to take care of them, and how would we deliver services? And I think over the 10 years the law has been in effect, we haven't seen that, and instead what we end up with is this really unnecessarily complicated system of delivering special ed services to this very, very tiny fraction of charter school students. So with that, we'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Cruz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is the Phoenix Talent issue a liability issue, or?
Mr. Chair, I believe the gentleman that I've spoken to is signed up to testify. And their situation, I think, a little bit, they might have some concerns about how the funding would flow to their school, but I think they also might have some concerns about some agreements that they have. As I was describing, there's this real intricate web of song and dance that sometimes you have to go through. And the head of that school, it sounds like, has done a very good job over recent years really negotiating with the districts that are responsible for these and coming up with agreements and making sure the money's flowing there. And so he's put a lot of time and effort into making sure his kids are getting the services that they are obligated to get under the law. You know, we're happy to take a quick pause and see if we can come up with a resolution and make sure that it doesn't impact his school. But I think ultimately this is the right policy direction to go. We need to treat these kids the same as any other kid attending a charter school.
I would agree.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
You ready, Mr. Chair? We have anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 71? On 71? On Senate Bill 71? Yes, please. Start off with your name.
All right. For the record, my name is Gary Temple. I'm the superintendent of Scioto School District, and we sponsor Oregon Connections Academy, which is a virtual charter school. Senator Haas, go ahead.
This is on Senate Bill 71?
Yes.
You're speaking on?
Yes.
Okay.
So we actually have 200 of those IEP students that Morgan was talking about. And Senate Bill 71 for us, and I'm going to tell you that it's not true for all charter schools, and Mike will talk to that, makes a lot of sense. And one of the things we continue to hear is, are these students getting their special ed services? And so if this were to pass, we would take on, as a district, the special ed for the charter school students. We would write the IEPs. We would then either contract with the sending district to provide those services and send them a check, or we would contract with our charter school to provide those specially designed services and send them a check. But in this situation, we would be able to make sure that their needs are being met. Right now, their test scores for their regular education does not come back to the district or to the charter school because of how they're enrolled. They're enrolled in the sending district. And this would change that and put those test scores back in our district. And that seems fair to me that we be held accountable for those. So I'm going to leave my comments to that and turn it over to Mike.
My name is Mike Warner. I'm co-director of Armadillo Technical Institute in Phoenix, Oregon. We were one of the first 10 or 12 schools chartered in the state. I'm also past president of the Oregon Association of Alternatives in Education. I've had a lot of experience, like 25 years of dealing contracts with school districts on these issues. We're about 1% of the state's charter school students. We're about 8% of the state's non-resident IEP students. We have the highest percentage of autistic and Asperger's kids in Jackson County. Well, my concern is I'm very much in favor of coming up with a model that's less complicated than the model we have now. Realize I have contracts with, I believe, 7 different school districts and have to bill them and track where students go and try to track where the funding goes every year, and I'd love to do that differently. But we're also in one of the smallest school districts in Jackson County, and the problem is, if you don't hold the districts harmless, in other words, especially in the initial 2 years of the biennium, here's potentially what can happen. If a district goes into declining enrollment next year, then money that normally they would have got to keep because they're guaranteed the same ADMR they had the year before is going to come over to us, which is great for us, but it's taking kids money away from kids in their district. And those kids that it's being taken away from primarily are going to be kids coming from outside the school district, and they're a small district. So having to pick up, having to transfer $100,000 from their students to our students, which isn't going to be made up by state funds if they're in declining enrollment, and they won't know that until next year. This is, so that piece really needs to be solved, especially when you look at the uncertainty of the economic times. And I've offered on numerous occasions to come up and work with department people on a solution for this. But for rural programs, it's not the same as it is in Portland. It's going to have negative effect on Portland because almost all the kids come from one high school in Portland. In rural counties and in rural districts, the alternative programs, charter schools, tend to be county programs because nobody can afford to duplicate everything that they do. We're the only completely choice program available to middle school and high school students in all of Jackson County. I have an IEP student who has Asperger's who comes from Grants Pass. Phoenix Talent has approximately 51 or 52% of the kids in our program. They have one-third of the IEP students in our program. Two-thirds of those students come from outside. And that's not counting the 7 to 8 IEP students out of 35 who came in after the December count, and nobody's going to get funded for. So I would like to see this bill happen. I'm willing to put in as much time as it takes to make it happen. But because I know school funding, I've spent 3 years making sure my kids get served. And for the first 4 years, we got no services from anybody, and districts collect funds. As it stands now, if you're not careful with this, it's going to require state enforcement, which the Department of Ed is not willing to do, because the measures that they would have to enforce are so draconian that you can't do it. If there are only 350 kids, holding the districts harmless by passing that additional amount of money through it is not going to affect the state budget. But in a district as small as Phoenix Talent, it could make quite a bit of difference. I mean, that's one teacher in a time when they're looking at, when all the districts are looking at cutting. So, you know, I want to support this bill, and there isn't a lot that would take to get me to be able to support it, and I'm willing to put in the time to get it there if you're willing to put in some additional time. It's, you know, one of the problems is these things get talked about primarily in urban areas, and the situations just aren't the same. And while it's not a huge number of charter schools, it's in our county, it's a huge number of kids. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Warner. I think what I heard the department say is your changes could be addressed.
Right.
However, if we do that on this side, by the time we got an amendment, mm-hmm. and then that puts us on the other side of the deadline for mm-hmm. these bills, you're saying that you'd be willing to have these addressed over in the House?
Yeah, that would be fine with me.
Okay. I appreciate that very much, and if there's any problem, just come see me.
Okay, great. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Senator Morris? Yes, I will close a public hearing on Senate Bill 71, and I'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 71.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 71.
Senator Morris moves to adopt the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 71. Discussion? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 71 as adopted as amended. Floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 71 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll support the bill with the understanding that the issue that Mr. Warner brought up will be discussed and addressed. And I know Morgan said that would happen, and I just want to put on the record that based on that, I'll be supporting the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, to back up what Senator Bonamici said, I might suggest that a letter accompany the bill over to the House to make sure that we fully support that amendment happening on the House side.
I think that's a good idea, and I'll follow up with a personal request to Representative Gelser.
Okay.
Further discussion? Seeing none. Any objections to Senate Bill 71? Seeing none, the bill passes with a due pass recommendation. Senator Metzger, you're next up on the list.
Okay. I like 71. That's a good number.
It's a tackle. It's a lineman number.
It is.
It is a tackle. You're right.
We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 122.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 122 comes to us from the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission and addresses licensure in alternative education programs. You do have a -4 amendment in front of you that specifies that the alternative education program, that the student's enrollment must be approved by the resident school district if the student is a resident in that district. And it specifies that the school district offering the student's program is eligible for that student's state school fund distribution. You do have fiscal and revenue impact statements on the -4s.
Okay, and Vicki Chamberlain is already here.
She didn't even wait to be asked, did she? She just shows up.
Ms. Chamberlain.
Chair House, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Director of Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. Did anybody else sign up? This is a bill that the agency asked to have drafted. The original law was drafted about 3 decades ago, and it said that any teacher licensed could teach in an alternative education program. Since then, the Commission's created several licenses that are for district flexibility. For example, we have a limited teaching license for painting so that community artists can come in and teach painting, and limited teaching licenses for ballet. Well, the Attorney General interpreted this to mean that any TSPC license could teach in any alternative ed program, and we know that was never the intent. So what the amendments do is tighten it up and just say that only non-provisionally licensed teachers in Oregon can teach in alternative education programs, which was the original intent of the legislation.
Thank you. Questions, Ms. Chamberlain? So we're talking a housekeeping cleanup bill. Is there anyone else here to testify in Senate Bill 122, which has been changed considerably since its original?
Do you want me to talk about that?
Senator Morris?
Are we in work session?
Just checking if you're ready. If there's no one else ready to testify on Senate Bill 122, I'm going to close a public hearing on Senate Bill 122 and move into a work session on Senate Bill 122.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 122.
Senator Morris moves the dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 122. Any discussion? Seeing none, so adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 122 amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 122 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, any objection to moving Senate Bill 122 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation? Seeing none, so ordered. I think that's all the bills we have for today.
Mr.
Oh, wait,
Chair,
there's one more.
A carrier for that measure, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonamici, would you like to
I will this? Do. Thank you.
We're going to stand in recess for about 60 seconds while we get the change our lineup here and get some of the sponsors down for Senate Bill 767. I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 767. Dana, if you could update us. Committee, you've all got the dash 3 amendments.
And I apologize, we got them at a late hour before the hearing, and they have not been summarized for you at this time. What else would you like me to say, Mr. Chair?
Can you summarize them for us verbally?
Well, Mr. Chair, I haven't read them.
To the best of your ability.
So I really don't think I should. I mean, we really got him just before.
Who said government wasn't efficient?
It's a good thing we're 3 in the afternoon and not 8 in the morning. Okay, well, let's call Senator Devlin, who's here, up. And Andrew, would you like to come up as well?
Hi.
Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Appreciate this opportunity here today. I want to tell you very clearly that charter schools, virtual or otherwise, can facilitate new and creative ways of teaching.
Who are you?
I am Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. I will start again, my good colleague. Charter schools, virtual or otherwise, can facilitate new and creative ways of teaching and learning. I have a long record of supporting public education. I actually believe very strongly in the importance of distance learning, both present and future. I believe it offers a great deal of opportunities in the present. I believe it will offer even more opportunities in the future. I actually believe there is a place for virtual schools, and I believe they actually meet the needs of some students. But even with all these beliefs, I do not believe we should sacrifice quality control, accountability, and transparency in the process. The underlying intent of SB 767 is to address legitimate public issues. While I anticipate that the bill as drafted will be modified significantly, I have confidence that the committee understands the importance of the intent of the bill and that the committee will come forth with a product that the legislature can support. In terms of Senate Bill 767, the bill is looking to clarify the 2005 legislature's intent when they approved SB 1071. At the time, SB 1071 did not contemplate that the charter school law would overlay the virtual school law or that an unintended loophole would be created. In this extraordinary time of economic crisis, when school districts face enough challenges managing painful budget shortfalls, they need some stability. It's also important to note that in this time, when schools are making tough choices, cutting days, cutting teachers, eliminating programs, it is more important than ever that schools that receive public funds operate with both transparency and openness so that taxpayers know where their dollars are being spent. Those for-profit, out-of-state corporations who run some online schools pose a real problem in terms of transparency if they are unwilling to disclose how public dollars are spent. These issues represent common sense issues, common sense regulations of for-profit corporations that operate publicly funded online charter schools in Oregon. Oregon students deserve equal access to public education, and Oregon taxpayers deserve to know that their tax dollars are invested in the classroom, bricks and mortar, or virtual. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you. Questions, committee? Andrew, I know you are here on behalf of your boss, Representative Buckley, and you have a...
Mr. Chairman, could I indicate to you that the Senate President is waiting for me to return, and you know how much patience the Senate President has?
Hey, thank you. We have no questions. Thank
okay.
you.
Yes. Chair Hess, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andrew Ainsworth, and I'm here on behalf of Representative Buckley, who wishes he could be here in support of Senate Bill 767, but unfortunately has other duties to attend to. However, I do have a statement from him that I'm prepared to read to you, and I shall begin. Chair Hess, members of the committee, I'd like to begin by thanking the chair and the committee members for your consideration of this bill introduced by Senator Devlin and myself. I believe we have reached a fair compromise with the amendments, and I would like to emphasize how important it is to move forward with Senate Bill 767. As co-chair of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, I am painfully aware of the need to spend wisely, especially when it comes to the state school fund. As we build a budget with $3 to $5 billion less revenue than anticipated, difficult cuts in our educational investment are being made, making every cent we do have count that much more. So you can understand why I'm extremely concerned about the use of our dwindling state school fund dollars to provide the profits for the out-of-state corporations that run some of Oregon's virtual charter schools. The status quo is absolutely unnecessary when other, far more fiscally responsible options for online education already exist in the state of Oregon. Oregon's own virtual school district serves roughly 103,000 students per year in Oregon's public schools at a cost to the state of merely $2 million per biennium. Using existing teaching staff and leveraging donations and affordable curriculum and technology from private industry, the Oregon Virtual School District has a proven record of providing valuable online education services at an affordable price. The Ashton School District, located within my legislative district, has been an early adopter of the Oregon Virtual School District to excellent reviews from teachers, students, and parents. Once again, over 103,000 students are served by the Oregon Virtual School District for only $2 million per biennium. By contrast, $30.6 million per biennium of other district state school fund dollars are siphoned off to support the Oregon Connections Academy's 2,700 students. The disparity is staggering, and as we struggle just to keep schools open, it cannot be ignored. Again, thank you for your attention to this matter. For every dollar, every cent is critical as we craft the budget during these unprecedented economic times. With that, I conclude. I'm not really comfortable taking questions on behalf of the representative other than to say his focus is primarily budgetary in this matter.
Okay, we'll let you off the hook. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, we have lots of people signed up to testify on this bill. I find that very encouraging that people come here to get their day in court. This is the second public hearing we've had on this. We're going to keep the public record open into next week when we have the next stop at this. So everyone who wants to be heard on this will be heard. We have a couple of ground rules, though. We would encourage you, if you have written testimony, to not read it verbatim, but to just pass it out. It'll all be into the record, and to just highlight or summarize wherever possible. So I'm going to go through our witness list and do two or three at a time, and I'm going to start with Lori Wimmer with COSA, OCA, and OSBA, and Dr. Doreen Dodgen-McGee. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for your record, Lori Wimmer representing the Oregon Education Association, its 48,000 members who, along with our allies and colleagues in the public education community, have been working on this issue for, I think, about 4 years now. We wanted to start by thanking, first of all, this committee and the legislative sponsors on the bill in both chambers for bringing 767 forward. We are testifying in support of the bill. I am handing out to you additional background materials along with my written testimony and also the letter of one of our OEA members who is an online educator, Violet Wilson, who is from Salem. She couldn't be here today, but she wanted you to hear what her thoughts were about the trade-offs and pros and cons of classroom versus online education and how to do it right.
And just to be clear, you're testifying on the Dash 3 amendments to 767?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We are in support of the Dash 3 amendments, and that is a set of amendments that represents a lot of work by people in and outside this building who all had concerns and questions, and we wanted to make sure that we could address all the concerns of folks that we were able to in the spirit of compromise, and so we're hopeful that that meets the needs to do that. The main concern that promulgated this bill was what we call virtual charter schools or virtual vendors, the for-profit primarily and generally out-of-state vendors who have used the charter school law as a way to access public funds for primarily a homeschool-based student population, not exclusively, but primarily, and to do so as a business model. It's a part of their business plan. The amendments are our best thinking on how to effectively resolve some of the unintended consequences of this phenomenon of the virtual vendors in Oregon. If you'd allow me to acquaint you with both the history, the issues, and the problems and our proposed solutions, I'll try to do that quickly for you. No matter whether students are served in a brick-and-mortar school or an online school, we believe that they deserve a good quality program that meets their needs, that are aligned to state standards, and that are done, and as you heard from the co-chair of Ways and Means, in an economically efficient way. First, some history. In 2005, Senate Bill 1071 was passed. It created the Oregon Virtual School District that you heard mentioned previously. And I was happy to be able to serve and have served on that the Oregon Virtual School District Advisory Committee since the passage of that bill. In addition to creating that online portal for access to curriculum for students in public schools, there was a limit put on the percentage of those students who elect an online program who could enroll from outside their resident school district. We do not have an open enrollment law in general in Oregon for most of our public education, because to have such a law would be financial chaos. And if you want good fiscal stewards in the 197 or 198 school districts in Oregon, you need to make sure that they have the ability to have some predictability and to manage well. But there is an exception, and with the virtual charter programs, students can be enrolled from anywhere in the state if the program contemplates no FaceTime from an actual teacher. And that's what's happening, particularly in the case of one program, or was in 2005, which is why the cap was put into the law, 1071, to make sure that that was discouraged as a general practice. Unfortunately, unbeknownst to those of us who were working the bill along with Senator Devlin, as he told you, unintentionally, we didn't contemplate that the brick-and-mortar charter school law, which had passed 6 years prior, that we needed to actually put this 50% cap on an unwaivables list in order to communicate that it was the intent that it would be a cap. And as a consequence, the education management organizations that have come into the state have ingeniously seized this loophole and have come to the state board in the last 18 months and in every case pretty much have gotten a waiver from the cap, which turns it into a paper tiger. So it isn't working, and we need the only way to fix that is to put it on the unwaivables list. So right now there are vendors who are lining up to get waivers. Some have already received them. Others are in the hopper, and still more are waiting on the sidelines ready to jump if this isn't fixed. And the board has passed them despite receiving numerous letters and much testimony from both legislators and education advocates. Some will argue that this 50% cap was intentionally created to be waivable, but as a person who is on the front lines, I can tell you that's not the case, and there was no testimony in committee about that. And in fact, the folks who felt that they would be harmed by it actively lobbied to have it removed from the bill, and if I remember correctly, it's 4 years ago, but I believe there was actually one or two sets of iterations of amendments that did strike it. But in the end of the day, legislators put it back in. And then in 07, again, they tried to remove it. Two different bills were defeated, and so we have the cap still in the law, but as I said, a paper tiger. So fast forward to 2009. In this grim session of economic crisis, the for-profit lobby is again trying to expand its presence in Oregon at the time when dollars are becoming contracted, and they'd like to kill this non-residency cap. The problem is that when you do that, 197 or 98 school districts and the 550,000-plus students they serve pay the price. It is a zero-sum game in the distribution formula. So rerouting public school monies to these programs and the shareholders they serve, primarily out of state, is not only financially objectionable, but it raises a host of other concerns as well. And some call it a backdoor voucher program. We have a number of related issues that this circumstance creates. In my written testimony, there are bullet points, and I also have given you colored sheets that identify in some depth each of those pieces. Budget transparency and accountability, disappointing student achievement outcomes are legendary in this community. Fiscal record-keeping and legal malfeasance across the nation, student access and equity issues, even in Oregon, and other consequences of privatizing our public education system. So SB 767 evolved since its conception, as you've heard, to accommodate the needs and interests of various parties. And the main elements of that amendment are these. We make the residency cap unwaivable, as I've mentioned. We ensure that public dollars support the optimal age level for online learning, and that's middle school and high school. This also ensures that income and language barriers of elementary students whose families cannot afford to or don't have enough English skills to homeschool them don't result in unequal access to public programs. We do have an exception for elementary programs that are based in a school setting. Establishes quality criteria for online programs. These are indicators that came from a work group in the 2007 session when those residency cap bills were proposed. What evolved was a work group, bipartisan work group with a lot of advocates, and these quality standards came out of that. They also exist in a bill this session, House Bill 2517, and we adopted them in this bill as well because we believe that they are good quality indicators for high-quality online access. We require evidence of sound financial management systems for charters. This comes from Senator Walker's Senate Bill 375. We ensure budget transparency in the flow of public school resources to corporate salaries, consultant fees, and profits. And we create an interim work group to craft a more ambitious vision for the appropriate statewide online access. And the best way to pay for this expansion in the future, and at what level. It is, you have a document from me that is a research piece that we did that shows all the online programs that are available that charge tuition, and you can see that the annual cost for a full course load, and some of them are as low as $800 a student, and yet these programs are getting roughly $6,000, a little less when they take the administrator fee off. It's about $5,700, near as I can tell. So this interim work group could take a look at what it really does cost to educate a laptop student versus a brick-and-mortar student. And finally, the amendments allow existing programs a one-year period to revise their school to comply with the residency law or to move to a larger school district where there'd be a better match of in- and out-of-district students or to allow their students to make other educational arrangements. There was a companion bill originally on the docket for today, Senate Bill 881. It has been removed, but that would have actually changed the distribution formula for the state school fund to these programs. And we think that the work group is a better place to take a look at that issue and so agreed to withdraw that bill. We know that from the minority of families who have signed on for subsidized virtual education, there will be some emotion about losing access to public funds should that come to pass for what is largely a homeschooling enterprise. Consider, however, the much larger number of homeschool children in Oregon whose families pay for their own curriculum, computers, internet, tutoring, and textbooks. Consider also, please, those 550,000 students in Oregon's public schools whose education resources are siphoned off after being sent by all of you to the 197 school districts intended for enrolled resident students. Their educational needs ought to be just as important as the minority who profit from this unintended voucher loophole. It's our hope that the Oregon legislature will ensure that the few never benefit at the expense of the many. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll go to you.
Okay. I'm Dr. Doreen Dodgen McGee. I'm a clinical psychologist. I've been in private practice in Portland for 17 years, and I am here in support of the Dash 3 amendments. And feel like I would like to just, when I go places and talk about this, which I have become an expert on overuse of technology for school-aged children, I usually have 3 hours, so I'm going to do my best to summarize, and if I leave some things out, I apologize, and I invite you to let me know, and I'd be happy to provide anything in writing you would like. About 5 years ago, I became very curious about what the impact of our fascination and passion about the explosive availability of technology, what kind of impact that was going to have on children. And I began to become very anxious about that as I realized how little research we had and how slow in coming the research was to let us know what the impact was going to be. So as my anxiety got higher, I began to look at old Life magazines, which I bought a few as a lovely visual aid, and began to notice a correlation between America's fascination with technology and our, in the 50s, post-war fascination with some things like cigarettes and convenience foods. In these magazines, I found over and over advertisements for different physicians recommending different cigarette brands. The thing that blew my mind more, though, was all the scientists, physicians, and parents recommending convenience foods, to the point that in one of these from 1954, there is an ad claiming that a glass of Tang is better for you than a glass of real orange juice. Now, this concerned me, so I began to look at the cultural, anthropologists look at this, and you see that about 10 to 15 years later, we find the beginnings of obesity, hypertension, high cholesterol, and the government comes in and says, maybe our fascination with convenience foods as side dishes has created an obsession and has created a main dish of convenience foods, and it's gotten out of control, and we introduce the food pyramid. But what we have seen now over time is that it's a little too late. My concern is similar with technology. Our fascination is huge. It's a great thing. I love technology. I embrace it. However, I feel like 10 to 15 years from now, we could find that overuse of technology could have some pretty dire consequences for our culture and especially for our children. Like I say, I embrace technology. I like it. I like online learning. However, I believe that these amendments could create some quality control standards that could make sure that the whole child and the whole picture is addressed during the school age years. When I was in graduate school 25 years ago, we thought that really all neural firing and wiring was done by the age of 3. And what we know now in just that 25 years is that neural wiring is occurring in robust ways all the way up to age 18, and now we're even looking beyond. We know that the brain during the school age years is wiring for some specific things. It's wiring in areas of relationship, emotional attunement, abstract thinking, retention and recall, and self and other structure. Neuroscientists are also paying a lot of attention to a region of the brain which they now believe to be the CEO of the brain, or the place where all executive functioning of the individual occurs. It's right behind the frontal lobe. It's called the prefrontal cortex. And the only thing that they can show for sure that develops the prefrontal cortex is relational attunement. That means that learning that takes place within a relational environment where people are bumping up against other people, against their own feelings and the feelings of others, that learning is more significant, more robust, and more long-lasting than anything that happens on a screen. When I started doing this research 3 years ago, the Kaiser Family Foundation, which has the most kind of robust and large sample size, showed that Americans were spending on average 3 hours in front of a screen. In 5 years, the newest Kaiser Family Foundation research now suggests that Americans age 13 and up are spending 6.5 hours a day in front of a screen. And if you control for multi-use, so that means on a computer while a TV's on, or on an iPod while you're on a cell phone, that looks more like 8.5 to 9 hours a day. And that is not with online learning. If you look at sole online learning, that number goes up significantly. Now, anytime a screen is engaged, the prefrontal cortex appears to have weakened firing or non-existent firing. So screen forms of stimulation miss the region of the brain that we're now saying is most important for all the things that are wired during the school age years. The goal of a child graduating from high school neurologically is to have a complex, integrated, well-working jungle-type brain, a brain that has wiring all around. And that means firing has occurred in that brain all around. I want to make sure that we as Oregonians are careful and moderate about how we provide stimulation and encouragement for our children to learn. If you look at the research, and this is, again, new research because this is a new area, there are also relational impacts that are huge when learning takes place exclusively online. We are graduating, if you talk with high school guidance counselors or individuals interviewing high school graduates, this is a generation of kids who has a hard time with communication. As texting has exploded onto the scene, they have less and less face-to-face communication. And if you look at a large scale, the largest scale to date, literature review out of USC, increased time on screens decreases family talk time, decreases social practice, and decreases self-esteem and self-soothing skills. That is a concern to me, so I would love to see some of this moderated. Again, I appreciate the opportunities that online learning can provide. However, I would encourage all of you to help us find ways of being moderate about our fascination, to not get us into a place where we are drinking only Tang and not orange juice, and to be thoughtful and forethoughtful about how to help keep funds where they need to be for children to have complex, integrated, multi-stimulated worlds within which they can learn. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. I embrace technology, too. In fact, that's why I got Senator Devlin down here, as I texted him a few minutes ago.
It does work.
It sounds like you're not saying all online
not
education,
at all.
But can you give us examples of where it is most appropriate and where it works best on what kinds of students?
Well, what we know is that learning that includes three things tends to be most robust in terms of both working memory and long-term storage, and that is learning that occurs with concrete, experienceable manipulatives, meaning when people have the ability to touch things, to feel them, to experience them, the learning tends to be encoded in the brain more robustly. Also, learning that takes place within the context of relational attunement, which basically means emotionally evocative stimuli. We all remember things where we're very scared or where we're very excited. We remember teachers who, created a relationship with us. Now, some online learning can do that. However, if all we have is screen forms of stimulation that miss that portion of the brain that account for relational attunement, the learning scientifically will not be as robust both in recall and in working memory. So some things that can, it's hard to answer because it's unique for every student. If you look at multiple intelligences, students who are what we would call visual or picture smart tend to do very well with online learning. However, students who are body or kinesthetic smart have a very hard time. And if we're asking only people who never see these students or even parents to make that assessment and make that determination, lots of students are going to get missed. So it's my belief that at least if there are opportunities for students to be interacting in complex environments where emotion is hit, concrete experience is offered, and meaningful information is given, hopefully we will capture the learning and let it be long-term for them. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thanks. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation. I found it fascinating. I wondered if you have actually studied students who are in currently in a virtual charter school and compared them with students who are using technology in a brick-and-mortar school, because I was trying to find through my notes, and we had a prior hearing on this, and I don't know if it was during the hearing or during one of my many meetings I've had about this bill, where it was explained to me that students in the virtual charter schools do not sit in front of a screen.
Correct.
All day, and so I'm really interested in whether you've had an opportunity to compare the number of hours that a student in a virtual charter school spends in front of a screen versus the number of hours at a traditional brick-and-mortar school, whether it be a charter school or a traditional public school, spends in front of a computer screen.
I have not. Really good online learning opportunities encourage interaction. I do know that they encourage field trips, they encourage group discussion, they encourage debate and thought. My area of expertise is typically in training educators, administrators, physicians, therapists, and parents. So I have not specifically looked at the two dynamics. I'd be happy to take a look and see what I can find.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Other questions? Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Okay, I have, let's call Bobby Reagan, Ron Nasso, and Jim Saffields up.
Did you forget the rest of the kids?
They're on deck.
Good afternoon. Chair House, members of the committee, my name is Bobby Reagan. I'm a member of the Portland School Board. I'm also currently the Secretary-Treasurer for the Oregon School Board Association. Since Oregon's charter school legislation was approved 10 years ago, Portland Public Schools has received 29 charter school applications, including one virtual school application. Portland Public Schools has approved 9 public charter schools and currently sponsors 7. Next year, the Oregon Department of Education will operate 2 and possibly 3 additional charter schools within our boundaries. In total, charter schools represent more than 10% of our district schools, and next year are expected to educate approximately 1,650 students within our boundaries. Portland Public Schools' charter school population is larger than the current total enrollment of the majority of school districts across Oregon. 2009 marks the 10-year anniversary of Oregon's charter school law. As with any new and sweeping legislation, it is good public policy to review and report on the impacts. Are charter schools living up to the law's original expectations? Are they improving student achievement? Are they innovative? And if so, how are innovations being shared? And perhaps most importantly, how are unintended consequences being addressed? Our board performance auditor just completed a first audit of our charter schools to date, and it responds to many of these questions. I will be sure to deliver copies of this audit report to you next week, once it's presented to the board on Monday night. I strongly encourage you to request a 10-year anniversary statewide charter school review to inform our decisions going forward. Portland Public Schools supports SB 767. In particular, we are pleased that SB 767 includes the requirement that 50% or more of the students who attend the public charter school reside in the school district where the charter is located. This reasonable provision allows students a closer working relationship with staff and makes provisions of the law around school-sponsored educational events and face-to-face meetings between teachers and students a reality. It also allows online teachers to spend more time teaching and less time traveling. In addition, unlimited statewide growth and competition among virtual charter schools would increase random diversions of public school funds away from other educational options. The 50% limit provides certainty and avoids chaos as large and small school districts struggle to work within our current financial realities. Our audit found that Portland Public Charter Schools attract a wider and more affluent student body than is the average for our district public schools. As such, I am pleased that SB 767 provides equitable access by requiring that each student have the use of computer and printer equipment as well as internet services. I'm also pleased that SB 767 limits enrollment to students in grades 7 to 12, as there are far too many questions about the appropriateness and practicality of an online education for students in early grades. There is also clear evidence that virtual schools operate at considerably lower per-student cost than other charters or traditional public schools, and this reality should be reflected in our state school funding formula. Finally, I ask committee members to consider online courses rather than online charter schools as a model for providing equitable access to online curriculum to every student in Oregon. At the OSBA COSA conference in February, I facilitated three discussion groups in which board members, superintendents, staff, and other participants shared with Senator Jeff Cruz their views around online learning. Overwhelmingly, participants recognized that online learning has a place in public education, especially when it comes to credit recovery, in preventing dropouts, and in allowing school districts to provide courses that students may not otherwise be able to access. Most helpful, participants said, would be a menu of online courses provided by a statewide entity and pre-screened to Oregon standards that school districts could access to complement their current curriculums. Such course access would not mean the loss of their student ADM, but would instead provide school districts with the opportunity to better meet the varied needs of their student body. So I ask for your support of SB 767 and the amendments that Lori Wimmer-Whalen just discussed, and for your support of a 10-year statewide review of charter school legislation and its impacts to date. And I appreciate this opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll go through your testimony and then ask questions.
Senator Hass, members of the committee, my name is Ron Naso, and I'm the superintendent of the North Clackamas School District, enrollment about 17,500 students. I've been in this position for 14 years. In that time, our district has approved and implemented six charter schools, one of those even before the charter law was written in the state. One of those charter schools is the Clackamas Web Academy, which is a virtual school which provides education services for over 400 students in our district, 112, grades 1 through 12. That particular Web Academy is one of the forerunners of what we currently are seeing in our state. So I don't come to you as an opponent of charter schools, nor do I come to you as an opponent of virtual education programs, because I think both have great value. I do come to you as a superintendent concerned because of real experiences over the 14 years about the strengths and weaknesses, more the weaknesses of the infrastructure, which is in place to guide, monitor, and govern the charter school movement in our state. While my concerns go to all charter schools, those concerns are most noted with regard to virtual school programs. Quick synopsis of those concerns. I'm not going to elaborate much. You've heard many of these things before. The state charter law, which was written a decade ago, even with the noblest of intentions, has been amended and manipulated to serve a range of very narrow interests, not the least of which is a virtual school industry. And I do want to be clear here. I'm not here to talk just about companies, business interests that are running virtual school programs. I'm here to talk about the school districts who are a party to that issue of spreading virtual schools in a business fashion. I think that is a major concern, since in one sense our CWA morphed into one of those concerns. I can speak, I think, with some legitimacy. I am concerned about a State Department office which has not been able to bring any sense of clarity to charter school law, most particularly the responsibilities and authorities of the local school districts in approving, denying, monitoring, and holding schools accountable. To be certain, a part of that lack of clarity is because of the laws themselves, which have been modified over the years to strip local districts of any sense of local control. I'm concerned about a State Department office which has control of significant federal funding and, quite frankly, at times gives the very strong impression that their primary mission is to spend that money, despite the realities of the applicants and local circumstances. I give you just a small example. In addition to the 6 charter schools that we have in the pipeline 7 additional applications. Now remember, we're a 17,500 student school district. One of those applications, which we have no reason to believe will be denied, will come from a 26-year-old young man who, to the best of my knowledge, will be holding his first job as a proposed director of a charter school. I have some problems with that, quite frankly. I am concerned about current laws which allow for the lack of transparency in the financial dealings of charter schools. We had, we started under one grouping at least, a charter school. It was sort of a flagship charter school called the New Urban High School. It's no longer a charter school. It is now, has been brought back into the fold of the school district largely because of some financial issues that caused the school to be unable to operate. It was not in the interest of the school district to close that school because it was serving our students. I am concerned, I would say I've got 2 other schools who we have had to work very assiduously, I guess, to try to keep alive because of some budget, what we think are some budget irregularities. I am concerned about the elimination of limits on numbers of students outside of a sponsoring jurisdiction who can enroll in a charter school. While I support the bill that's on the table with the 50% rule, I would want to say to you that I am more supportive of the 80% rule that once upon a time existed in the earlier legislation. I think charter schools should be about educating youngsters in their local school districts. That the 20% was thrown in there only in case there was a space available. I now have charter schools in my district where the majority of students do not live in our school district, and I just don't think that is right. I am concerned about the lack of innovation in charter schools. We have received a number of applications, as I have said. The original legislation thought of charter schools as being the R&D, if you would, for education. We were going to see innovative approaches to improving the quality of education in our country. The nature of the applications that we're receiving, I would have a hard time arguing that they represent innovative approaches to education. They represent largely attempts to isolate groups of families, groups of parents, in a school that will be just their little school. Finally, I have a concern about the use of virtual education as the educational vehicle, and I will say the sole educational vehicle, for students in grade 1 through 6. I think that while we have not heard scientific testimony, I think just on surface it is suspect, at least. And you as a legislature should be concerned about that. Existing charter law, which was originally crafted at a time when there was intense political pressure to initiate charter schools in our state, needs to be reviewed in its entirety. 10 years later, we've had both successes and failures in charter schools. We've had considerable monies that have been redistributed around the state. We have virtual schools and private companies using the charter laws to establish lucrative but largely unmonitored businesses. We believe that this legislature needs to step back and examine what the original charter school legislation intended to accomplish, what has actually been accomplished, and what we should be attempting to accomplish in the future. Short of this overall review, you will be dealing, I believe, every session with constant flows of amendments to what I think is fundamentally flawed legislation. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
My name is Jim Saffields. I'm assistant principal for Roberts High School, Salem-Keizer Public Schools. My role has been as a founder for SK Online, a district online school, as well as the Bridge program that serves as a program working to recover dropouts, mainly in the grades 11 through 12, and through, again, online learning. I have been, I'm proud to say, the father of students who have been online. I've been a web developer. I have been an online teacher, and now I'm an administrator of an online school within an alternative high school within Salem-Keizer. Roberts High School could probably be best described as a hybrid school in which we've got students moving from either face-to-face settings within our structured learning program to fully online within SK Online. We're also pulling back, again, dropouts who reside primarily within Salem-Keizer, pulling them back from the brink of dropping out of their current high schools, or they have dropped out, and we're using online instruction within a limited setting with at-the-elbow support to help them complete their high school diplomas. SK Online's been a project of development over the past 10 years. At one point, I was also a prime author of a charter proposal to Salem-Keizer in which we would take SK Online and essentially morph it into a charter. But the school district as a whole, leadership, I should say, as a whole, as well as ourselves, took a look and said, no, we can innovate within the existing rules and regulations and guidelines and oversight that the Salem-Keizer Public School District could afford us. At this current point, Roberts High School has an enrollment of 850 students, about 170 in SK Online, about another 400 in the Bridge Online program. All told, though, we also provide additional 1,200 courses, course seats, if you will, to high schools within the Salem-Keizer Public School District, as well as providing support to districts by request such as Amity, Dayton, Madras, and in fact in Madras we've replicated essentially our Bridge program so that they can provide dropout support within their high school as well. We provide learning support for online courses within the Marion County Jail, Marion County Juvenile Detention. We use it to supplement our face-to-face self-contained classrooms within the Structured Learning Center, and we also provide a summer session in which we serve nearly 600 students, primarily within Salem-Keizer. We're focused primarily on high school. Our district determined that the greatest need was helping students reach their high school diploma. We hope that I can show you that we're proof positive that online learning can innovate, can survive, can work, can expand within current state guidelines, within current district oversight. As a matter of perspective, Roberts High School with all of our combinations, we're the school with the largest senior class in Salem. We helped more students complete a high school diploma. So we're one of those sort of secrets within our school district. Some of the things that have guided us as we've developed our online program is maintaining a connection to state and district standards, maintaining that accountability to our school board, staying within our bargaining unit agreements. Our teachers are paid the same as any other contract teacher within Salem-Keizer. It's different work, but the workload is equivalent in the sense that our teachers write herd, if you will, on 200 students on a daily basis. That writing herd is different than preparing lectures and delivering in front of the students. Instead, it's a matter of making connections, reaching through whatever means we can to build strong relationships with our students. We're operating fiscally responsibly within our general fund budgets. Students come to us through a transfer agreement within the school, so we're working collaboratively. If we're serving a student that is beyond our district, usually that is a supplemental course, and usually that is working through the high school administration or the high school counselor at that district or the inter-district transfer rule. We see that collaboration is extremely important within our district as well as between districts. Districts need to use their student counts, their projected student counts, to forecast staffing, even to forecast construction of new buildings. We heavily rely upon local school districts as well as our local districts. High school counselors for background when it comes to where a student's been in regards to special education, behavioral issues, any sort of special needs that they may have. Our content, we use a combination of teacher-developed coursework. We use our own in-house web design as well as purchasing courses or vendor-produced content. The main key is, will it all fit within our ADM revenue? Can we make this work within our budget? Can we pay our teachers? Can we purchase content? Can we provide our infrastructure all within that fiscal constraint? We also collaborate with Willamette ESD when it comes to contracted services for mundane things such as taking attendance online and grade reporting. When it comes to special education, we provide IEP support. We provide that on-site, actually, learning lab where students can come in and make that connection and get that extra push that they need. When it comes to success, it varies. We're taking a risk, especially when it comes to students who have dropped out. They've learned how to fail, and that's tough to overcome. That being said, within our supplemental program, and for example, Sprague High School, we have an 80% completion rate of our courses. The Bridge program, where we're really focused on bringing kids back from the brink of dropping out, 100 students out of our 400 last year, 120 of those students graduated and completed Salem-Keizer diploma.
Mr. Sapphiles, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap it up here.
Sure thing.
I appreciate your testimony and both of you. I do have a question to you, though, and to Mr. Nasso. You both indicated that online education, when it's a complete online education, is either difficult or inappropriate for students under sixth grade. Could you comment on that? Did I hear that?
I think it's suspect. It is something that I think you, as the legislature, we as educators, need to review. When we first approved our online charter school, it was approved for 9-12. And over the course of 6 or 7 years, it has morphed into a 1-12 program. You know, we have 3 or 4 students that need some special help here, and it just kept growing downward. I continue to remain skeptical. But I think it is something that needs to be examined and needs to be examined very carefully.
We have served elementary students, probably the youngest student we've served is probably a fourth grader who is ready for essentially high school level math. But the younger the student, the greater, in our experience, the younger the student, the greater support both the school and parents have to provide and have to be prepared to provide.
Questions? Thank you all.
Thank you.
Okay, COSA, OSEA, OSBA. Tricia Smith, Chuck Bennett, Rob Wagner.
Go first.
Is that right? Thanks. For the record, Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Rob Wagner, representing the American Federation of Teachers, Oregon. Our members are working pre-K through post-secondary in Oregon, public and private institutions, and along with my counterpart here, Tricia Smith, from the Oregon School Employees Association, we are the largest affiliate of the Oregon AFL-CIO. AFT has long supported publicly accountable charter schools, and in fact, this last summer, our members organized Ridgeline Academy in Eugene. And we stand pat with good public accountability for public resources. In terms of this bill, we are supportive of Senate Bill 767 and including the Dash 3 amendments. Closing a loophole, which is essentially what we're looking at, is a backdoor voucher program. We, especially in these financial times, believe that there should be a responsibility for public resources, state resources, and we also look forward to the work group piece of this bill, looking at financial accountability, best practices for curriculum, and opportunities to maximize student learning. So with that, there's been a lot of testimony, and I know you have a lot of people to hear from today, so I will turn it over to my counterparts. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association and its 20,000 educators throughout the state. We are here also in support of Senate Bill 767, the Dash 3 amendments. The pieces of the bill that we think are the most important are making the 50% requirement unwaivable. When we first put the Oregon Virtual Schools district in place in statute, we never anticipated that we would need to be sitting here talking about this again. It was always our understanding that online schools were a great addition to our public school system, but would never be meant as a replacement for the brick and mortar schools. We believe that the 50% unwaivable is very important. We also believe that the prohibition against full-time online school for primary grade students is also important. My folks are very supportive of the charter schools and the online schools in their districts with restraint. They believe that small children need the social interaction of a classroom. They need to hear the questions that the other students pose when they're discussing issues, because those kinds of interactions help them bring their subjects into a place where they make sense to these kids. They think that social interaction in schools for small children is a very important part of what we do in our schools, and so they think that this provision in 767-3 is very important. We also believe that the transparency requirements and the financial accountability requirements in 767 are very important. We think anyone who uses public money to educate a child needs to provide the public with the information about how that money is spent, and we think that 767-3 begins to provide that kind of accountability for all of us. And we look forward to the discussion in the interim that 767-3 creates, where we can look more closely at the other finer issues around virtual learning and try to come back to you with legislation that takes a fuller look at the issue. And with that, I will move on to Mr. Bennett.
Mr. Chairman, Chuck Bennett with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Mr. Chairman, I think you would find, and committee members, I think you'd find that the comments from Bobby Reagan and Ron Naso, from Portland and North Clackamas school districts would be repeated by superintendents throughout the state. The concerns that they expressed, particularly those I'm thinking of from Superintendent Naso regarding the entire state of affairs in the charter school system, are ones of tremendous concern around the state and among a vast majority of the school districts in the state. Ms. Chairman, through my own experience, I'm very concerned by the absolute lack of standards developed by that would be, if they had been, developed by the State Board of Education for granting waivers to online charter schools. They seem at times capricious. They certainly are situational, and they're absolutely unpredictable as to how those waivers will be granted, because there's just nothing in place that clearly delineates, that they're following, that clearly delineates what are going to be the reasons and what are going to be the factors included in standards for online charter schools, or virtual charter schools, and that ought to be a concern to all of us. No matter what happens, though, committee members, we do believe there needs to be a review of the best system, online system we can develop that will guarantee that every Oregon student has access to online classes. What we have now is not it, but there needs to be something in place that does guarantee students have access to online courses. And with that, Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you. Questions of our panel? Senator Metzger.
And we don't need to all answer this, but whoever feels they just have the most information on it, maybe. So I just have one particular question on this serving the 50% rule with the school districts. And there's a lot of issues here, but just dealing with this one. I can see that issue when Superintendent Nasel testified, which is my school district, one of my school districts, 70. You know, I think that's a different situation to me than when I think of distant rural schools that are very small, and to make it viable for those few students, that, you know, it may not work. And I know it's very, very hard to always have this one size fits all for anything, because we have all these issues. But just off the top, maybe a thought about if we were to go ahead with this 50% unwaivable type of rule, to make sure that we don't go the other way where we can't get people in. You know, we're doing a lot of talk, Mr. Chair, about ESDs and things and moving those numbers down, but trying to make them serve a certain area. You know, some thought about having some type of medium position where you might have the 50% waiver, but maybe applies to, it must be reside within the ESD district, or something. I'm thinking primarily of these rural areas that, you know, have a few students here, a few students there, and what's the, maybe the virtual thing, charter school will make more sense there, as opposed to Clackamas, where the aggregation of students to access other types of things other than just the online part of the instruction are there, but where you don't have all those abilities somewhere else. Any thoughts on something like that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, I think you're describing exactly what we need to get rationalized in a discussion of opportunities in online education, making sure it occurs statewide. But I would tell you that there are a variety of online learning opportunities that are not charter schools, including the state's virtual school curriculum that is available. In fact, I was talking with Vicki Fleming over in Redmond this morning, and she wanted me to be sure to mention, I just remember as you brought that up, how important that is to even a school district the size of Redmond to have available to them that curriculum and the ability to get at it. So those of you on Ways and Means, I hope you'll take Superintendent Fleming's comments to heart. We also have groups like the Frontier Learning Center and the way it has dealt with online education. There are a variety of models. What we're, I think, most concerned about is the situation where you have a for-profit, out-of-state or in-state company coming into a small district or even a large district and trying to put on what would be under our charter school law, a virtual school program without meeting that 50% rule. And I'd say the same thing if Spray tried to do it and was grabbing students from Portland to come on to a virtual school program out of Spray. And we have situations where really the losers around the state in some of these virtual learning programs are small districts in rural areas. So their loss of a student can be very important to them. So there's a lot to be done here. It's just we haven't done the work yet to get it, I think, rationalized and standardized in some way.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, if I could just add, I think it's very important that we look, and that's why we support the interim committee, it's very important that we look and assure that students in Oregon have access to program. I'm not sure it's so important that a school district create a charter school so that their children can have access to online learning. It's not like a bricks and mortar school where it's got to be there in the district, and obviously, because that's what we're talking about here. So access for students to online education is an important thing. We need to look at it and see where we're missing the mark.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. And Mr. Bennett, you make sure you tell Superintendent Fleming that you forgot to say what she asked you to say, but you were not from Senator Metzger.
She's watching.
Tim Colahan, Bonita Fillmore, and Alan Bruner.
Mr. Chair, was that pronounced K-O-N-A-N-T-Z?
No, sir. Sorry. C-O-L-A-H-A-N. And again, if you just want to start off with your names and don't read your testimony if you don't need to, and highlight where you can.
Good afternoon. My name is Tim Colahan, and I'm from Burns, Harney County, Oregon. I want to tell you a little bit about myself first. I grew up in Burns, graduated from high school there, went off to college, law school, came back to Burns about 22 years ago to raise a family. I have three sons. My children have either all graduated from Burns High School or are currently enrolled there. I have a middle son who's a junior in high school who's actually enrolled in the virtual charter school that has been sponsored in our community in Harney County School District Number 3. So what I want you to know first is that my interest in Senate Bill 767 is not based on any opposition to the role of virtual charter schools in education in Oregon. Rather, what I want to do is to explain to you a little bit about our experience in my community, and I think it will demonstrate and explain to you the reason why there needs to be the type of oversight and regulation that are provided in the bill. As many school districts in Oregon, our community has certainly experienced damaging revenue cuts due to reductions in state funding. We're looking at huge cuts again, of course, in the coming year. And our decisions are hampered a great deal because not only is the state cutting the funding, obviously, but our enrollment is continuing to decline because of declining employment in Harney County. Last spring, our district looked at the possibility of creating a virtual charter school in our community. In fact, in the spring, they included anticipated revenue from a charter school in the budget for this year, even though no such school had even been approved as of yet. The charter school proponent marketed itself as an opportunity to increase revenue for our school district. In October 2008, the school board approved a proposal to form a virtual charter school. They did so on the representation that revenue would actually increase as a result of opening the charter school earlier than originally had been proposed. Our district was also told that startup costs for the charter school would be funded by a charter school incentive grant, that the district would receive a new computer lab, and that the charter school would, quote, not cost the district a dime. The very next day after approving the proposal, a five-year charter agreement was signed by our district superintendent to create the charter school, and the charter school opened. In December, the community learned that no incentive grant was received and that the school district was actually fronting the charter school operating money until state revenue would begin being received in February of 2009. The district was assured that all fronted money would be repaid by the charter proponent this year and that the district would also receive additional revenue pursuant to the charter agreement. To date, state revenue has increased, but it is questionable whether district revenue fronted to the charter school will actually be recovered this fiscal year. No new computer lab has been constructed. Because the new state revenue has not come in as represented, the charter school is now proposing a change to the charter agreement regarding the proportion of state money that will be paid to the charter school. In truth, nobody knows with any certainty how much new revenue this virtual new charter school will actually bring to our school district. The experience of my school district demonstrates the need for SB 767. My concern is that cash-starved school districts that are presently very vulnerable to promises of new revenue that are being made by virtual charter schools. SB 767 would bring regulation and oversight to an area that is presently ripe for exploitation and overreaching. It would also ensure financial accountability of virtual charter schools. This bill delays impacting current charter schools to allow students, families, and the schools themselves to make alternative plans in order to come into compliance with the new regulation. I urge your support of this bill. And, Mr. Chair, I would Senator Metzger raised an interesting issue. Obviously, Harney County is pretty rural, pretty remote, and your question about whether or not services for some of these remote schools, French Glen School District has a wonderful online education program, totally unrelated to virtual school of any kind, and they've got a wonderful computer lab also. So if you've got interest, you might look into that.
Thank you.
But thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you. And we have the honor of having one of the Teacher of the Years here. Was it last year, 2006?
2006, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead. We have your written testimony. No need to read it.
Okay. Well, again, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Alan Bruner. I'm a teacher of science and mathematics at Colton High School, which is a small and rural school in southeast Clackamas County. I wear many hats in my educational adventure here in the state. I'm currently the president of the Oregon Science Teachers Association and am nationally board certified. I'm here today basically to give a little bit of my history because one of the hats I wear is as an online educator for Cool School, which is one of the online providers of course for small and rural schools operated out of the Lynn Benton Lincoln Educational Services District. So I'd like to give a little bit of history. I've been associated with the Cool School and its predecessor, Cyber School, since its inception in 1989. First developed by Tom Layton and Jack Turner of the Eugene District, it ultimately morphed into an outstanding program using an ESD delivery model. It gave me opportunities to work with students all over the state, primarily in the rural south and east. Had the great privilege of working with a student from Burns High School. A piece of what becomes important is just recognizing that there are models out there that are highly effective with online learning, and there are standards for online learning instruction. And it becomes important for this committee to understand that when done correctly, this does have accountability. And it does have accountability within a framework of local control. And that's probably the biggest issue that I see in looking at all of the arguments. I sit on the State Board of Education as the teacher advisor, and I've had the opportunity to listen for the last 18 months the conversations, both pro and con, about the strengths and weaknesses of virtual, online, comprehensive education. And one thing that comes up again and again and again is the issue of transparency, the issue of being able to see exactly where taxpayer dollars go, of being able to see exactly what curriculum standards are being used when we say our curriculum is aligned to standards, of being able to look at how educators working with our students online have not only been trained, but how they're licensed, how they're highly qualified, and how they're being administered by those individuals in administration over them. As you see in my written testimony, Cool School has an outstanding model that has highly qualified licensed teachers in all subject areas. The other thing that becomes important is that we, in fact, have gone through professional development training specific to standards that have been developed for online learning. If you go to the Cool School website, and I've provided that URL, what you will see is a budget analysis and breakdown of every cost for every class. So when we look at the issue of transparency, there are models out there that are outstanding models that provide local control and keep ADM in local districts and still have oversight by local taxpayers and patrons. When Cool School was established, it was designed primarily to augment and enhance local schools' offerings. I mentioned that I wear a number of hats, and as president of the Oregon Science Teachers Association, I would like to say for the record that OSTA has some grave reservations about the ability of students using online learning options to meet the new essential skills. Scientific inquiry and being able to perform process skills is something that requires lab work, something that requires interaction face-to-face, or at least interaction of an intense nature that allows people to question, allows people to challenge, and allows people to ultimately defend their understandings of science. This is what we expect our students to do here in the state. It certainly should be something we expect students in an online environment to do. And at this point, the Oregon Science Teachers Association does not believe that can be effectively done in an online environment. Before online learning came to Oregon, those people who chose to teach outside of a traditional bricks and mortar made very deliberate decisions. And many of those individuals, and I have consulted with many of those individuals because I do provide homeschooling consulting, many of those individuals made deliberate choices about why they were using non-traditional educational methods. But they also understood that they were not state-funded resources. People who choose to educate their children in private schools understand the same. They're making a very conscious, deliberate choice. It's unfortunate that the charter school law put into place to provide for needs of a wide variety of non-traditional students has been corrupted to provide tax dollars for alternatives marketed by online vendors with little or no public accountability. For that reason, members of the committee, I would urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brewer. Ms. Fillmore?
Hi, I'm Benita Fillmore from Klamath Falls, and I'm here to just talk for a little bit about my granddaughter's experience at the SIO online school. She was enrolled last year, last school year, 2007-2008, and she started off a little bit behind. The materials were a little late coming to her, but she started going really good with it, and everything I heard was how wonderful it's going and what a great job she's doing, and she's right on it. My son then moved into the Springfield area over the summer, and in this fall, she decided to go back to public schools, and she is repeating her seventh grade class again, what she did this last year. And I was really kind of concerned about that all the way, trying to figure out what was going on. And I asked my daughter-in-law, and she said that they were restructuring the school about halfway through, and that some of the things that should have been happening every week, she was supposed to have phone contacts with her teachers every week, and that wasn't happening. And that it's just kind of she fell by the wayside after about the first half of the year. One of the biggest concerns that I personally had is my granddaughter has Asperger's syndrome, and She's very, very smart. The schoolwork really isn't a problem for her, but she has horrible social skills, and I worried about that a great deal, that she was spending her time on the computer instead of developing those skills with her age group, being with kids of her own age group. So, thank you.
Okay, appreciate that story. Any questions over our panel? Thank you all.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Konatz, now is your time. Yeah. Todd Thorpe and Karin Heikes. I don't know if you wanted to testify or not, but I have your name on the list.
Mr. Chair, I just want to let you know that I have to leave at 5, and it's because of a prior engagement that I told you about, and I just don't want anybody to think that I'm leaving because I don't want to hear the rest of the testimony. I wish I could, but I have somewhere I have to be, so I will definitely listen to the tape and read the materials. Thank you.
That old excuse. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, staff, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is James Konatz. I'm the Senior Vice President with K-12 Incorporated. We partner with the Oregon Virtual Academy to provide online services, materials, curriculum for the children that are in that academy. It is an online school here in the state of Oregon. My responsibilities are in school management and school services. My background is I'm just finishing my 41st year in public education, starting with Los Angeles Unified School District, it seems like a century ago, well, maybe a half a century ago, and moving from classroom teacher to special education educator to district administrator, finishing my career with Los Angeles Unified as assistant superintendent of schools in charge of instructional technology. Moved on to taking care of charter schools as assistant superintendent. So I sat on both sides of the desk as we listened to charter school applications and charter school granting processes. After that, I moved on to something that I believe strongly in, and that's the power of technology today. When you couple it appropriately with learning methodology, with experienced, highly qualified teachers, and a world-class curriculum, you get outstanding results. I've been very impressed today with the testimony that I've heard so far about the need and the challenges out there for online education in the state of Oregon. We're pleased to say that the Oregon Virtual Academy is one of those R&D schools that you can count on to be not only transparent, but also effective. We've heard some testimony today of, I believe the research goes back to Life magazine in 1958, bringing about some question about, is this appropriate for young people? We heard some other speculation that it may not be appropriate for children in the early grades. I'm here to say that the research is much more current than what was brought to you today, and there's no speculation in that research. Over 50,000 students just in schools that are associated with the K-12 incorporated curriculum and delivery system are out there, spanning the grades from kindergarten all the way through the 12th grade. So there's no loss of outcomes to look at or speculation if early childhood education can't possibly be given to young people through computer-assisted applications. Dr. Jane Healy in 1998 did some research that really was formative research for all of us in the field in structuring online education for early education. In her book, Failure to Connect, she points out a lot of areas at that time that were very difficult for children to make a connection between the learning process and the entertainment process. That is foundation research, and in technology time 10 years ago is 100 years ago almost, because the half-life of technology, you know, is very short. It moves very quickly and very rapidly. Vendors today understand the brain-based research in the application of the appropriate use of technology along with traditional methodology in manipulatives and associative designs, in being either a tactile learner or an audio
file where you enjoy listening and learning more by listening than you do by reading. All of these types of learning modalities that are out there can be accomplished and are accomplished. The real key is how do you organize the instruction? It's not if it's computer or not, it's really how do you organize the delivery. For instance, in our schools, the delivery is organized quite well, and the spinoff is that we want to move every child through a free and appropriate public education, understanding that not one child is needier than other children in education. Everybody deserves a free and appropriate public education. But organizing that so everyone can achieve. For instance, in the early grades, the doctor that testified is absolutely right. Time watching a screen is not good education. But having computerized delivery of some aspects of it, plus the use of manipulatives and reading and talking and being able to draw and being able to design and be able to touch and to feel and to experiment, is really what makes education meaningful in the early grades. So in our schools, if you were to look at the chronology of development, you would see in the early grades that probably 5, 10, 15% of the time or the material is delivered via the internet over a computer. So grades K1, 2, and 3 really rely on more traditional aspects reinforced by a learning coach and a highly qualified credentialed teacher right here in the state of Oregon. As you move towards the middle school grades, you see that start to change a little bit because, as you know, if you were at all familiar with parent participation in schooling, you know that in the early grades, there's about a 90% participation rate of parents in the early grades, drops to about 25% in middle school, and less than 10% in high school. Well, with that in mind, if you look at the online education in our schools, you see that the shift starts to take place at middle school, where it's about 50-50, 50 traditional, 50 online. You get to high school where we want the students to be independent thinkers and be able to think on their own and learn on their own. It starts to shift even a little bit more. So it gets to be about 60-40, about 60 online and about 40 offline, with more traditional face-to-face synchronous approaches. So it's not one size fits all, as was implied. It's not a discussion of everything on the computer. It's a discussion of how you organize the continuum of education from grade K through grade 12. I was also impressed to hear that many of the areas in Oregon are dealing with credit recovery in high school. I was surprised to hear a science educator say that students can't learn science online, or imply that they can't learn online because they don't have those kinds of experiences. We had our first graduating class in California. We had one young man that was with us since the fifth grade, and he's been in a virtual school in California, one of our schools, since the fifth grade. He was accepted to UC Berkeley, he was accepted to UC Davis, and accepted to UC San Diego, all very, very difficult competitive schools to get into. As you probably read, Berkeley had over 50,000 freshman applications. He was one of the ones chosen. That goes for our young people that were also accepted to typical schools, UC Davis and UC San Diego, majoring in biology and chemistry. Where else but online today can you afford the risk of being able to titrate a highly volatile solution? You can't do that in chemistry lab in high school anymore. You can do it online. Where else can you dissect a frog or an animal? You can't do that anymore. You can do it online. So when it comes to A&P, anatomy and physiology, all those things are readily available today. You see some of the displays out here, the materials the children get in our schools. No one wants for materials. There isn't a child that doesn't have everything they need. Bags of peas are sent for them to grow in. The soil that goes along with that is sent to them to make sure that they can run an experiment correctly with the right controlled conditions. And everything else that they need, musical instruments go out. There's laboratory equipment. There's clay. There's art projects. So I'm absolutely impressed with online education, as you can tell. I think it's really a structural item. I think we have to be careful because I'm asking you today, do not shut down these schools. Your actions today can prevent that. So in opposition to the bill, I say, do not shut down our schools. There's a lot of opportunity there. It's not a school for everyone. It's not going to take over all bricks and mortar schools in the state of Oregon. But there has to be that fair and equitable distribution of educational access across any state. I would shudder to think that some of the smaller areas that Senator Metzger talked about or other communities would be redlined and not be able to take advantage of high-quality advanced placement courses or high-quality foreign language education for the young children. I think the doctor that was here, and I don't want to speculate, but I will speculate on this one, that she would also endorse the fact that the best place for a young person to learn a foreign language is in the early years. Our school provides five separate languages that students in the early grades and their parents can provide online education and learn Spanish or Chinese or any one of five out there. So I ask you, please do not shut down our schools. Please make sure that you do whatever homework's necessary to understand that it's not one size fits all. Please understand that there is accountability. All schools should be required, and we do provide a yearly independent audit to the sponsoring school district and, if necessary, to the State Board of Education on the financial condition of each school, where the money was spent, where it went, and who was hired. And then finally, as I was saying, you don't have to go that far back to find good research. Toward a new golden age in American education is actually the U.S. federal government publication and how the internet, the law, and today's students are revolutionizing expectations in education. And I brought one for each of you that I'll leave with the assistant. Thank you.
Ms. Thorpe. Mr. Chair and committee, thank you for your time today. My name is Todd Thorpe. I'm the head of school of the Oregon Virtual Academy, sponsored by the North Bend School District. I'm here today just to give you a perspective on Senate Bill 767 and how it would affect our school in particular. You may be aware that we are the school that has a two-year waiver from the State Board of Education that has many conditions, one of which is a 600-student cap. And the district release form from each school. So I will discuss that briefly as well. I'd like to point out one thing in regards to charter law, which is ORS 338.025, which talks about the State Board's education to grant waivers. And what that says is the State Board of Education may grant a waiver of any provision of this chapter if the waiver promotes the development of programs by providers, enhances the equitable access by underserved families to the public education of their choice, extends the equitable access to public support of all students, or permits high-quality programs of unusual cost. So I think under those criteria, a virtual school fits every single one of those. And what this is saying is that the State Board of Education only needs to find one of those criteria in order to provide a waiver. And again, I feel that the Oregon Virtual Academy meets all those criteria in which it did receive its waiver. So with that, I would ask that the unwaiverability of the 50% rule not be enforced. with that, I'd like to move on to the third page of the handout, which does show the students that were denied by districts to receive a release to come to the Oregon Virtual Academy. What you can see, there were 13 different school districts, and there's been a lot of discussion today about the equitability and being able to provide access to all students, especially in the underserved areas in these rural communities. And I think it's really important to remember that if that's our goal, that we need to ensure that students from all districts do have the ability to come to the Oregon Virtual Academy and other virtual academies that may have the waiver restriction provided on them as well. And then on the next page, I'd just like to briefly illustrate a few of the denial reasons that were given for denials to the students requesting release. And as you can see, there's no uniform standard for the reason of denial. So I would request and urge that if district or sending approval is something that is going to be considered,
and that there are uniform standards put in place to ensure that it is fair and equitable across all districts. And with that, I know we have a busy day, so.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is it Mr. Conant?
Conant.
Hope I got your name right. Thank you. First, I want to say that I really wish that I would have been able to dissect a frog online when I was in school because
it was terrible.
It smelled really bad, and I think I would have been spared that.
Well, we have the answer for that.
I think you said that there at the younger grades, the elementary level, there was 90% parent participation, and I'm curious about who is participating in the other 10%.
Well, that's really on those parents that are involved in back-to-school nights and their child's education at their local elementary school. They have a lot of engagement in the early grades, and that wanes towards high school.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
I was understanding that you meant that in your particular virtual charter school.
Oh, I'm sorry. In our particular virtual charter school, it's actually parent engagement that starts at kindergarten and continues all the way through high school. The high school dependency on a parent is a lot less in the education portion of it because, again, as I tried to point out correctly, I tried to point out that we want to move students from being dependent learners to independent learners, and in high school there's less requirements for a learning coach and or a teacher's involvement in everyday activities because we want them to learn independently. So it's a progressive nature. But in the school itself, it moves parents along with the students in the educational process. As a matter of fact, we have a lot of parents that come to us and say, I learned more about art and science now that I ever did when I was in school before. And that's one of the spin-off effects of having this type of education that parents are 100% involved in, is being able to have that family education component right along with it.
Okay. Can I ask a follow-up, Mr. Chair? What I want to ask is about that parental involvement, because from the prior hearing that we had when people were explaining how they work side-by-side with their student in the online learning, what I'm wondering, and I don't doubt that you have many people who are successful. In fact, your story about the student who's been accepted to good colleges, I don't doubt that. But I wonder if you've ever had the opportunity to compare the success of your students with the public school brick-and-mortar students who have a parent at home and who have that level of parental involvement. Because what I'd like to sort of separate in my mind is how much of the success is attributable to the fact that the students have a very involved at-home parent versus the actual method of online learning.
I'm sorry, I wouldn't have that information. I don't think I've read a study on that as a comparison to a traditional public school.
Okay. If anybody knows of that kind of study, I'd be really interested in hearing that.
Sure.
Because I'm a public school parent, year 15, and it's pretty clear that there are many, many successful students in a traditional brick-and-mortar public school, and a lot of that is attributable to the extent of parental involvement and whether they have a stable home and whether
Absolutely.
Their parents are there at home when they come home from school,
yeah.
which all of your students have, but not all the public school students have. So I'd be really interested in sort of a comparison between where that success is coming from. Is it based on the extent of the parental involvement?
Mr. Chair, may I respond?
Please.
Please. Yes, there is some work that's out there that classifies a successful school, and the components are that you have a highly qualified faculty, a very strong curriculum, and parent engagement. Those are the factors that go into a successful, high-achieving school. So that's the limit of my knowledge at this point.
Setting aside the 50% issue for a moment, neither one of you have issues with the transparency requirements that are in these amendments and legislation, or do you?
I'll have to defer to transparency requirements. I don't know about that. No, I'm sorry.
On behalf of the Oregon Virtual Academy, we're okay for the transparency requirements in the amendments.
Okay.
Yes.
Further questions for the panel? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Representative Wingard is here. I'm so sorry I didn't see you come in. Did you want to testify? in support of this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Matt Wingert. I'm a state representative from House District 26. I have been monitoring the committee hearing in my office and was compelled to come down and respond to some of the descriptions of online schools that have been made today. Just to be clear, I have had a working relationship with Oregon Connections Academy since it started, and I helped had some part in helping to bring it to Oregon, and I'm very proud of the option that that offers to public school students throughout this state, and the 20, now somewhere in the vicinity of 2,600 families who benefit from that public school option. It was suggested that these schools are not accountable. And I want to be clear about a couple of things. One is that these schools and all charter schools are subjected to an annual audit, and Oregon Connections Academy does an annual audit, and done by an outside auditing firm. I would ask what other public school receives an annual outside audit. Charter schools, including Oregon Connections Academy, can be shut down for non-performance. They worked on a very strict set of accountability measures that are in their contract with the school district. And again, I would ask, what other public school works on an accountability contract and faces the prospect of being shut down if it does not achieve the results that it promised? Every one of these charter schools, everyone, including Oregon Connections Academy, is a nonprofit. The vast majority of money spent in a charter school is no different than the money spent in a public school. It's on salaries and payroll. And therefore, the vast amount of money, the vast majority of the money spent in Oregon Connections Academy is spent to pay its teachers and administrators who are in the state of Oregon. And therefore, the vast majority of the money stays within this state. To the extent that there is money that flows out of state to Connections Academy located in Baltimore, it is for curriculum services. This is not dissimilar to what other school districts do when they buy textbooks from McGraw-Hill, which is also a for-profit company. School districts around this state buy textbooks. They contract with companies to build schools, and they buy computers. Those are all for-profit companies that supply those services to our public schools. Lastly, I would just like to suggest that I think that the bill, including the amendments, have the cart before the horse. You're asking for a work group to delve into this, and I think that's a good idea. And frankly, I would support the idea of creating a work group. But I think you need to have the work group first to actually look into these questions and provide some answers before you move on the kind of solutions that are offered in this bill, which I oppose, but I think can be rebutted. So, I think it's a little bit awkward to be moving a bill that already reaches some conclusions and then at the same time create a work group to try to ask some questions. Let's ask the work group to consider very carefully whether or not the remedies being offered in this bill truly would benefit the public school students of this state. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Representative, I just wanted to remind you that under the No Child Left Behind law, schools that don't measure up are shut down. That's federal law.
Mr. Chair, theoretically, that is what is supposed to happen. But having worked in the public education reform arena for a number of years now, and having closely studied, for instance, what happens at Jefferson High School in the Portland Public School District, which is one of the worst, if not the worst, performing public school in the state, it has never been shut down. They are often just reconstituted. And there's a lot of things that remain the same about the school, including staff members. So I agree with you that technically, in the law, that is what's supposed to happen or could happen to a district-run public school. It seldom actually does happen.
Okay, thanks.
All right, Christy Ollinger, Brad Lynn, Angie Armstrong.
And whoever's stuff this is, Senator Cruz offered to carry your books home
from
school.
Chairman Haas, committee members, thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Christy Olinger, and I am a teacher with Oregon Virtual Academy. I teach grades kindergarten through eighth grade, and I am also the special education case manager. I hold an Oregon State teaching license for elementary education as well as special education. Teaching in a virtual charter school is an amazing opportunity for teachers like me to expand our experiences working with students and implementing a state and nationally accredited curriculum, utilizing cutting-edge technology. I'm concerned about legislation, especially Senate Bill 767, that would essentially close our school, Oregon Virtual Academy, and others like us. Such a closure would be catastrophic for thousands of Oregon children and their families. While teaching for Oregon Virtual Academy, I am rewarded daily with meaningful and measurable student successes. Traditional brick-and-mortar schools are not capable of fulfilling all the needs of every child. A virtual school is equipped to offer more of a flexible schedule, where students perform their duties from their own homes. Our students feel safe and happy at our school without the threat of being bullied. We are an especially great fit for those students who are very bright and therefore able to take coursework above their grade level. We're also a great fit for those who struggle with special needs, especially those who suffer from autism, autism spectrum disorder, and Asperger's syndrome. With daily social threats removed and the addition of their parent or other adult who serves as their learning coach, students that struggle with the social aspect of education are now succeeding. Losing our school would be a devastating blow to their education and have negative repercussions on them becoming successful adults. All Orva students receive a full set of textbooks, workbooks, videos, CDs, and manipulatives like microscopes, math blocks, and etc. In the red suitcase alone is the over 50-pound box of books that comes for a first-grade student. Our elementary students generally check the computer in the morning for lesson assignments, and then they spend the majority of the day offline working in their books, reading their books, constructing science experiments, creating art projects, engaging and interacting with their learning coaches, and then return to the computer to take online assessments, at unit and lesson assessments. These assessments provide data for teachers so we can produce individualized learning plans for each student. Our students are held to a higher standard than those in the traditional brick-and-mortar classroom. They must pass each assessment with an 80% or higher to be considered mastered, each assessment. I meet with my students multiple times per week online, which also creates a sense of community. All of the faculty have open office hours, which provide students with free access to their teachers and allows them, along with their learning coaches, to come in for extra help or explanation of assignments. All of the teachers are only a phone call, email, text message, or instant message away. The faculty also travels the state, providing fun and exciting activities and outings for students to gather with other families and socialize and meet up with us teachers. These outings take the learning outside the virtual classroom and include trips to OMSI, factory tours, nature hikes, and bowling, just to name a few. We have extensive contact and develop meaningful relationships with our students and parents and learning coaches. I love my job. I love teaching these students who just so happen to be some of the most committed students in our state. The proverbial light bulb is going off across heads in heads of students across our state. I urge you not to close our school and take away a job that I love. I'm a professional educator, and these children are not only succeeding, but they're thriving. Thank you for this opportunity, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Senator Haas, committee members, my name is Brad Lynn, and I am the principal of the Clackamas Webb Academy. I think there should have been some takeaways passed in your possession that have, if you open them up, they're a collection of some of our newsletters and also a calendar that represents some of the classes that we offer on site. I'm providing those to you to illustrate the hybrid model which our students and teachers operate under. And also to show you that the Clackamas Webb Academy, defined by law, is a virtual school, is offering much more than students accessing curriculum online in front of a computer. I'm here today to advocate for our elementary program, students and families and teachers being served in that system, and ask that you consider that as you look at Senate Bill 767. The Clackamas Webb Academy is a public charter school sponsored by the North Clackamas School District. We are also accredited by the Northwest Association of Accredited Schools. In our program, we serve 440 students in a grade 1-12 model. Our program is divided up into three systems. As I mentioned, we have an elementary program that serves kids with about 125 students approximately enrolled in that system. Our middle school system has 80 students approximately participating at that grade level. And then our high school system that serves kids grades 9-12, and that being the largest of our program. The teachers in our program are all certified and highly qualified to meet federal mandate. And they use the virtual program or the online curriculum to complement and support teaching and learning in our system, much like a regular teacher would use a textbook in a classroom. Because our teachers are all certified, they are developing other supplements to provide students activities and enrich topics that they're learning online. They're also asked to support and create enrichment classes at our school site. And students regularly participate, whether it be math tutoring or actually working with, in a wet lab, materials and manipulatives to take learning and accessing curriculum forward. And if you look at our April calendar, and again, that is provided in the handout that I set up, you can see some of the classes that we offer at our school site, and they range from elementary age all the way to high school. In our program, we've developed several partnerships. We use Odysseyware to support our core curriculum, but we're also using Rosetta Stone to provide our students an opportunity to learn several different languages. And that goes beyond just the high school model. Even students that are elementary age are able to participate in that. We've also have established a business partnership with 24-Hour Fitness to allow our homeschool students, home-educated students, the opportunity to participate in physical ed and use our highly qualified teacher to support that work downstairs on our campus. Our school has been recognized at the state and national level, and I think it's important that I mention that. Currently, we've been the recipients of the Oregon Dissemination Grant, which is giving us the resources to help other schools look at the new Oregon diploma as it's being rolled out. We've also had a presence at the Oregon Charter Conference, where we've presented on three different sessions, looking at our hybrid model, but also discussing issues pertaining to the new Oregon diploma. And in June, we will have a presence at the national conference being held in Washington, D.C., where we will be discussing on topics pertaining to supporting the whole child. And a lot of that is going to be geared at the elementary level and a lot of the work that we're doing at the middle and high school level as well. In closing, the Clackamas Webb Academy does support a lot of the language that is boasted, that is posted in Senate Bill 767, especially the language that talks about best practices. A lot of that is because Currently, we're operating in compliance to that language, and we think it is best in terms of how we serve students in our school district. However, our issue with Senate Bill 767 primarily comes with that of accessibility, and as a charter principal advocating on behalf of our elementary school teachers and families who have chosen to come to us to be served, I ask that you think about that as you look over some of the language in Senate Bill 767.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
a question
if I may, Mr. Lynn. Are you at risk with the language of Senate Bill 767? Is your future at risk?
Currently, having not looked at some of the amendments, what I know of the law does limit access to our students who are in grades 1 and 6, access to our program. Like I mentioned earlier, we do have 125 students operating in that capacity. We have 6 certified teachers that are supporting that system. So, yes, it would affect us negatively if it were to pass.
Thank you.
Hello, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. First of all, I want to say thank you for providing this forum so that we can express our support for virtual public education. I really appreciate you taking the time to listen to all of us today. My name is Angie Armstrong, and I am the president of the Oregon Virtual Public Schools Alliance. We are a group of parents that either have children in virtual public schools or we want to have children in virtual public schools, but they've been denied enrollment. We're here for one reason, and that's the main reason is we want what's best for our kids. As parents, this is what we think is best, and that's what we'd like to see. And now with the introduction of these bills, we want to see the virtual schools stay open. So the two reasons that we're here today. We are pro-public education. A lot of us have students that are in traditional brick-and-mortar schools, and we also have students that are in virtual schools. Basically, what we're looking for is a school that fits the student the best, what serves this student, what is most appropriate for this student based on his or her individual needs. A lot of students struggle in brick-and-mortar schools, and for those students, what we want to see is a quality alternative. Right now, those choices either don't exist or they're in danger of being taken away for a lot of Oregon families. I'm a mom from Coos Bay. A lot of people ask me, how did you get involved in this issue? You know, why is it so important? And I'll tell you, I wanted to enroll my 3 children in a virtual school. I gave it a lot of thought. I considered it. I researched. I did everything, and I said, I choose the Oregon Virtual Academy. This suits my kids great. I submitted enrollment, release forms to the Coos Bay School District Superintendent, and he denied my request. I made several attempts to meet with him, to discuss why, and just to get a general idea of what is the criteria, because while some students were being released, mine still were not. I was ignored, basically, by the Coos Bay School District. Never got to meet with anybody that I requested to meet with. No return phone calls. My point, Mr. Chairman, is I don't think that's any way to teach parents. To treat parents, okay? And I certainly don't think it's any way to support the education of our children. I want what's best for them. I think that the educators want what's best for that individual student, and there has to be a way to come together and make that happen. If Oregon is going to have virtual public schools, and we do, I think that they need to be available to parents regardless of where they live. I think that Oregon needs to make a long-term commitment to online education. And even though they're virtual schools, they have every bit the community as a traditional brick-and-mortar school does. They have great families, great teachers, great lessons. It's all the same as far as these kids are concerned. We were here with one message, and that's to save our schools. My kids are still not enrolled in a virtual school. So it's not just about save my children's schools. It's about equal access to education, allowing my children in, allowing hundreds of other children that may benefit, allowing them in, instead of leaving the decision up to somebody who may or may not know. In my case, the Coos Bay superintendent doesn't know my children because they've never been in the Coos Bay School District. So he gets to say, and he has that right, as it stands right now, he gets to say whether or not they can or they can't go. I know them better than he does, and that's a fact. but what I would like to see is, I want the educational choice to belong to the parents and not somebody who may not even know these students. I don't want to see a system perpetuated where one child gets access and another is denied. And without explanation, I just think that's wrong. If you're going to deny me or refuse to see me or whatever, please tell me why. Just let me know why. Otherwise, I end up as a president of a alliance, and I want to change things so that other people don't have the frustration that I'm having to deal with right now. Anyway, I hope you hear our message today and protect this, what I think is a very, very promising and valuable educational system to many kids in Oregon right now. I think a lot of them are succeeding, and I would hate to see that taken away from them, and they may have to struggle into something else. Just please carefully consider the power that you wield over our families right now. I hope once you hear our stories that you'll ensure the long-term viability of online education in Oregon, and thank you for giving us the opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Questions, committee? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just so everyone knows, normally this committee goes from 3 until 4:45.
Well, normally we meet from 1 to 3, but that's all.
No, we normally go from 3 to 4:45, and today we're going to go an extra hour, but we are going to leave at 5:45. We will not be able to accommodate everybody that's on the list today. This is our second round of hearings on this bill. We'll have another coming up, I believe, April 22nd. So just so everybody knows that. I do want to see if Karen Heike is here. Did you want to weigh in on this bill, please?
Thank you, Senator Haas. I apologize. I was in the hall when you called my name the first time. Senator Haas, members of the committee, my name is Karen Heikes, and I am with the Northwest Center for Educational Options, which is a state charter school resource center. Our core mission is to support high-quality public school options so that all Oregon children can find the right choice for them and to thrive in a school that best meets their needs. I thank you for the opportunity today to talk with you about the virtual public charter school issues. I've been actively involved in these issues for the past 4 years, sat in, I think, on every meeting that has occurred on these issues, and participated in a number of conversations and work groups and so forth. So I am not here to express support or opposition for 767 at this point, although I will say that we did not like the bill in its original form, but we have been working with OEA and with some of you and with other partners on amendments, and we are hopeful that we can reach a consensus bill before the session is over. I am here today to talk to you about my organization's views on these issues. Oregon has 88 public charter schools serving approximately 14,000 students, which is about 2.5% of Oregon's K-12 student population. Of these 14,000 students, about 4,000 are served by 9 virtual charter schools, which is less than 1% of Oregon's K-12 student population. In our perspective, virtual charter schools offer one option of many other options in terms of the continuum of options that we have. We live in a culture of choice. We have choices for everything, so many choices, you know, of every product we want to buy, everything we want to watch on TV, everything. And we do believe that children should have options and choices in terms of what kind of school they attend in terms of the educational model. And the virtual model is one, and it's not for every child, but it is for some, just like Montessori and Waldorf, expeditionary learning, direct instruction, arts and science, early college, and any number of other options that we have in our system. The current 9 virtual charter schools that we have do not all have the same academic model or operational model, even though they're all online to some extent. In terms of policies, again, we support high-quality public charter schools, virtual or otherwise. We believe that public charter schools are schools of choice. Therefore, we support parent choice, but we want to balance that with preserving core district programs and services. We believe in creating a level playing field for all existing and future virtual schools, charter or not. Even more critical to us, however, is creating a level playing field for our students. You heard last week from the Oregon School Boards Association about why, some of the reasons why the virtual schools overlap with the charter law. There are a number of other things that the virtual schools overlap with: our funding system, our enrollment system, geography, and a number of other issues. It's a very complex issue that we find ourselves grappling with. I will say that NWCEO supports legislation and policies that ensure a balance between parent choice and preserving core district programs and services, that ensure appropriate types and levels of accountability and quality for all schools, that assure consistency in terms of quality standards amongst all schools. I think this is the one area that everybody agrees on even now, the quality standards. They've been drafted over the last several years. And also policies that ensure funding equity for all Oregon students, which would entail closing the current funding gap between traditional public school students and public charter school students. We would support perhaps two interim work groups. One, on virtual education, K-12, charter otherwise, and another on charter schools, because of, as others have mentioned, we've had the law for 10 years, and it probably would be valuable to sit down and take a look at where are we, where do we want to go, and be strategic about that. I would like to say that I will not use this time to make sweeping statements about the charter law or the practices or other issues that are beyond the scope of this bill, like some others today have done. I would welcome the opportunity to have a true dialogue with accurate data and real information about what's happening with the charter law and practices around this state. Thank you for taking our input into consideration. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Well, thank you, Karen, and many, many thanks for working on this and trying to work in good faith to reach consensus, and that's certainly our goal here. And we very much appreciate you doing that, because you don't have to do that, and you do. So,
thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Going down our list here, Elaine Bach, Jan Michaels, Brandon, and Wayne Sanchez.
Good evening now. I was prepared to say good afternoon, but my name is Elaine Bach. I am the proud mother and learning coach of a 15-year-old boy who 2 years ago was seriously close to committing suicide. And it was primarily due to the treatment he received at a traditional bricks and mortar school. He was being secluded. He was being sent home with piles. I mean, I'm not talking 4 or 5 pages. I'm talking about 10 to 20, maybe more, pages a night of schoolwork. They expected him to get all of this done over the weekend after being kept in at every recess, every lunch, for months. I counted 2 months where he got to go outside 3 times because he couldn't get his work done. The frustration of not being able to get help, the teacher not liking his job, told all the students in his class, "I can't stand this job, I don't want to be here," didn't want to help the students.
I'm sorry, what school was this?
In Jervis Middle School. I left him in that school way too long, I'm afraid, and it got to the point where I realized that I could lose my only reason for living, which is my son. And I didn't make him go back. I kept him out for the last 2 weeks of school. And the schools gave him, which is amazing to me because he got Fs all the way through every class all year, they gave him his 8th grade graduation diploma. What for? to push him away, to get rid of the problem child. He has ADD and we suspect he has Asperger's. They didn't want to work with him. They just wouldn't. I found Orca. He is now carrying 3 A's, 2 B's, and 2 C's, and he has not dropped them all year because I'm there. I'm a single widow. If it wasn't for me being there, I quit my 40-hour a week job. I'm now working 2 to 3 days on the weekends only because I love him. If it wasn't for parent involvement, these kids, some of these kids wouldn't be making it. And this school provides that opportunity. The curriculum is engaging. It is challenging to him. Excuse me. It is very challenging to him. This morning, before I left to come here, we built a roller coaster. Because in his science class, he was studying kinetic energy. And we had to explain how it worked to his teacher. I learned a lot today because I didn't know half of that stuff either. He is in contact with not one teacher, but 7 all week. They are there at a moment's notice. If he needs them, he picks up a phone. You know, he's not sitting in front of a computer all day like everybody makes you think they are. He's got stacks of textbooks. He has books he has to do. He has a schedule he must keep. This school has higher expectations of these kids than I've ever seen. And he's been in bricks and mortar schools since he was in kindergarten. I have homeschooled him 3 years out of his life because of bricks and mortar schools not measuring up to him, to his expectations and mine. My homeschooling didn't measure up either, so I had to put him back. And then we found Orca, and I don't want to lose Orca. And we're asking you to please save this school, because I don't want to lose my son or all these other kids. Just thank you for listening.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that very much.
Chairman Hassan, members of the committee, I too would ask that you please don't close our child's school. My name is Jan Moss Michaels, and I live in Springfield, Oregon. My husband and I both have postgraduate degrees and are parents to 7 children. And only one of them is in the Oregon Virtual Academy, and his name is Alex. Last year, Alex was struggling in middle school. He was in 6th grade, and he was bringing home straight Fs, and that was after we tried everything possible to encourage him and bring those grades up. And he had wonderful teachers at Briggs Middle School, and they tried everything to encourage him and to get it changed, and just nothing was working. So at the end of the year, we decided that we would look into some other options. And when we started researching it, we heard back from Orba, and when we heard back from them, it literally, I thought it was too good to be true, because they answered all of our needs and questions and problems and concern that we had. Alex is, you know, accountable for doing work and keeping up with education requirements for his level. It provides it with enjoyable material that he likes, and now he actually is succeeding, and he really enjoys learning. This school has really benefited him, and like I said before, it's not for everybody, and our other children do great in the public brick-and-mortar schools. They thrive there, and this sort of education wouldn't be for them. I just ask that you consider that each child, they do learn differently. They are people, and they have their own learning styles just like everybody else does. And I just would ask that you save this opportunity for the children that it does benefit, because it should serve a purpose for those kids that can't thrive in a public brick-and-mortar school. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair.
I was just disturbed by what you said about your child at Jervis Middle School who gets straight S and graduates. So, Mr. Chair, I would like, I want to find out how that happened. That's,
I wish somebody would.
you know, if we could, you know, get your name of your child, your teacher, your school, I just wanted to explore that. If that is accurate, I want to find out why.
Well, it was the same with our child, except for he was in sixth grade. He was moved on to seventh grade.
Okay. So if we can get that, I will follow up on that.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
If you want to leave your information with our administrative aide over here, Bonnie Allen. Thank you.
Senator
Thank
Morris. You. And along that line, but would be beyond the scope of your ability to find out. But I would like to express an interest, I think, for the committee to understand what are the assessment scores for students that are in charter schools, online charter schools, in the public schools, bricks and mortar. So we can understand, because what we're hearing is that the quality is lacking. What data do we have that suggests maybe otherwise or confirms that? I don't know. I would like to see that information, Mr. Chair, if that's possible.
I think we can do that.
Well, I think I can shed a little light on that data. The curriculum definitely isn't lacking at this school, at Orca anyway. My son, like a lot of kids, the 10th grade benchmark assessments that they are required to take by the state of Oregon, he went in February. No, January. In January, he went in to Salem, to the State Board of Education, and we were doing the tests. They test them on the entire year's curriculum, not just what they've done up to that point. He just started the year. He not only passed, but he excelled by at least, what was it, 8 points on one test, 7 points on the other, and 6 on the other. He hadn't even done the work yet. This work, the expectations that they have on these kids is tremendous, and it pushes them to do better. And with the parent involvement and the teachers actually talking to the parents, it helps so much. You know, they act like parent involvement is a bad thing. My son did go to a few schools where they wouldn't talk to me. He was doing really well, but I still had no communication. Communication is the key to life. It's the key to everything, relationships, school, everything. And if you don't communicate back and forth, you don't know what's going on. And I tried communicating, like at Jervis. I tried the minute he started threatening to commit suicide when it got really bad. The first thing I did, I went to the principal, I went to his teacher, and I went to the school counselor. And they said, oh, we got to have a meeting. We had a meeting. That's all that happened. Nothing changed. Absolutely nothing changed. They just met. Changes have got to be made for these kids.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you all. And we'll get that if you'll get that Thank information.
You.
Our last panel here, I'm going to try to do 4 people, if you can try to be brief. I have Annette Trucker, Gary Tempe, Patrick Donaldson, and Michael Warner.
You passed over Wayne and Brandon Sanchez?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
To call them. They just didn't come up.
Wayne and Brandon Sanchez. Why don't you come up next? You didn't come when you were called.
Wasn't enough chairs here.
Gotcha.
Thank you, Chair Haas and committee. Appreciate this opportunity to speak with you today. I'll make this brief. I'm a parent of my son Brandon here. We received Brandon from foster care when he was 8 years old, and enrolled him in of course, the public school system in our area. And we, as parents, we are very committed to our children, very much involved in our children's education and their lives, and have struggled from the time he's been in school throughout his middle school and the starting of high school have struggled with Brandon's education, including he had an IEP and that wasn't really working. And we calling, working with his teachers who say they loved parents to be involved in their students' education, but when it came time to really be involved with the parents, to be involved with the education, they weren't as forthcoming and helpful as they said they wanted us to be, and that they wanted to be. And so, throughout high school, or as he was going through high school, it got to be where it was an open campus, and as he was struggling in his classes, as he had been all throughout, getting D's and F's, and feeling like he was feeling left behind in the classes, as they kept pushing him through his classes and advancing him, I think he was taken advantage of. I'd rather just not be in class. And so as parents, we pulled him out, and our option was online schooling. And as parents, that has been a blessing to us, as we've been able to work hand in hand with our son to help him in his education. We've seen his grades go up to C's and B's. We see that his attitude has changed. We have a much better relationship with him now that we work with him so closely in that. And he has a social life on top of that. He does interact with scouting and sporting events outside of that. And no, he's not in front of the computer, 24/7. But he does spend his time there. And we as parents are able to regulate with him his work and what he's comprehending and following through with him to make sure that he's doing what he needs to be doing. And so as a parent, I really support the online school. And I'll echo, please don't close the school. And with that, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate
it. Thank you. Where are you from?
Corvallis.
Corvallis.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks to both of you for coming up.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Annette Truckee, and I'm from Eugene. Thank you for having me. I have two sons that are enrolled in Marcola Web Academy. We came upon the Web Academy as they came into the area in Tulane County, and we felt like we found just the right choice for our kids. We have two sons, one's in high school, one's in fifth grade. They both take three main core classes with the academy, and then they take classes outside, and they both have interest outside of school also that they're able to focus a lot of time on. My oldest son has taken classes at the college, community college, and taken culinary classes, and that's one of his great interests, is that along with dirt biking, and he's been collecting sponsors, and he works on all sorts of things aside from school. This gives him a certain freedom to do so. I think that this model, this educational model, is a very valid way to educate our kids. I appreciate it, and I would be devastated, not only for our kids, but for others, if this bill passes as it is. And so I would hope that that you could kind of put the brakes on it and really look into it before our lives are changed, especially as soon as next year we would be out of a school for our high school son, and that's kind of traumatic to change in the junior year. People do it, and they do it okay. But for this one, I don't think it's a great way. And so thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Warner.
Thanks. Sorry to do it twice in one day. What I want to address is the cap. I think you cut the other piece from in the last set of amendments that required interdistrict transfers of all students attending public charter schools. So I think that's taken care of. Here's my primary concern with caps. In every district in the state going on right now, when almost any student is entitled to alternative education, as the student that students you've heard about here should have been notified about in writing and apparently weren't, almost always one of those options is homeschool, which means at best 5 hours of home instruction a week. That's considered a perfectly viable model. I've worked with students who are chemically dependent, who were expelled from school for violence, and that's the option that they get. I don't care about caps per se, because What I do care about is that you, if you're going to cap something, you remove those caps for students who are entitled to alternative education. Let them choose from any publicly funded school in the state they wish to go to. Take that power away from districts. Two, any school, any student that's been out of school for 3 months ought to be able to attend any school they want to go to, whether it's one of these models or some other. If they're homeschooling, they're not, you know, the idea that because a parent does not want to send their student to a 2,200 student high school, most of my middle school boys came to us because they got tired, they went to a big middle school and they got tired of being beat up every day. Big high school, big school districts spend more money on security than we spend on our program in a year. That's not because they're bad programs, it's because they're big. If you have 2,200 students on your campus, you're going to have those problems. We know from research that those kinds of schools are not as effective as smaller schools, but I don't hear the state saying we're going to require you to be a 450-student high school or a 400-student middle school, and you must build more buildings. The district has the option of providing every one of these kinds of programs that kids are taking advantage of. Some choose to do it, and you've heard about some of them here today. Both my children went to public schools. My wife teaches in a public school, and I can tell you wonderful things about their public school experience and nightmares about their public schools experience. The public schools are not bad places. I'm getting tired of the rhetoric where we vilify each other in order to save options for children. The only thing that matters here is kids who aren't being served getting served. You know, you've got Phoenix School of Roseburg. You should have seen it during when we had 25 kids and what we went through every year and the kinds of things that were said about us. None of those things were true, and none of them turned out to be true. And now you've got a model of how it should work. The people who've talked about getting together and getting into this and talking about the difference between, in my view, a virtual school, which is not online learning, virtual schools, children attend school virtually. Online education is something different. A brick-and-mortar school is something different. And they all need to be looked at. But we don't need special standards for a public charter school that's online, different from the standards we would expect of a mainstream program that's online in terms of the quality of the program. And whenever our state goes through one of our recessions, as we're going through now, everybody gets terrified. And everybody gets territorial about kids. And fewer kids get served. And that's what happens. There are 1,000 to 1,500 school-age students, and that's just based on the dropout stats, in Jackson County right now without a place to go. There is one choice model that serves 110 kids at a time. The problem is not too many opportunities for children. Now, I've been doing, you know, my mission's been at-risk youth since the beginning. That's 30 years. I've worked with kids in residential treatment. I don't have a problem with the public schools. I believe in publicly funded education. If you want to prevent, you know, if you want to say you must be a nonprofit as you've done, great, say it. I'd agree with that. If you want to say you can't hire a management firm, regardless of whether you're a public school or a charter school, whatever, fine, say it. If you want to say that you must have state-approved curriculum in online programs, say it. And do it. But in my county, as we speak, well, at least when we started the hearings, there were students sitting in front of computers doing Odyssey and Plato for test prep. Okay? Going on right now, that's not significantly different. There's a school that I used to teach in my county, doing credit retrieval. I had 60 students enrolled in my class, grades 9 through 12, and GED. Okay, that was going on. I don't think it's going on anymore. But it's not at the same time. That same school district has one of the best, most progressive teen parent programs in the state. You can come up with good, you know, let's look at standards that make sense. Stop vilifying each other. And where we're talking about kids in crisis, Kids who have been expelled, suspended, or dropping out, won't go, are afraid to go. They need options. And the fear that 400 or so students attending a public virtual school is going to destroy the school system in Oregon, or that those kids aren't entitled to a publicly funded education because we don't like the way it affects the other 55,000 students or whatever we're talking about. To me, that's not a valid argument. They pay taxes. They're entitled to it. And I don't think you're going to hear anybody from charter schools talking about we don't need standards and we don't want to live up to them. I don't think that's the model. I don't think that's what's being done. And in terms of the issues around finances, I don't know what happened in North Clackamas School District. All I know is that my school board and my can ask for any document anytime they want, whenever they want. And if I said no, they would say that was grounds for ending the charter. So I'm not sure what happened in North Clackamas. I just know in our tiny little school district down in Phoenix Talent, that doesn't happen. And in most of the schools I'm aware of, that doesn't happen. To me, that I find that an interesting thing. I really appreciate you guys taking the time to do this. And again, this is something, especially in terms of caps, that I'd be willing to spend some time on.
Thank you, Mr. Thank Warner. You. Any questions? All right, thank you, and thank you all. I apologize that we just can't get to everyone today. The record is open, and we will take another swing at this.
Make a request, Mr. Chair.
Senator Metzger?
Just to make a request. I know we have 7 or 8 folks left, and they may not be able to come next time, but if we could maybe accommodate them at the head of the list, maybe then rather than hearing the same old people re-sign up the next time, I'd like to have an opportunity for those people to, if they have to come down, to at least hear from them.
Certainly. Okay, thank you. Thank you all for coming. If there's no further business, we are adjourned.